This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Just over a decade ago, the World Trade Organization, or WTO, approved a series of quotas that limit both the import and export of textiles and apparels between countries. 3 years ago, China joined the WTO. Now the quotas expire at the end of the calendar year, so let's say you're an American textile maker. You put two and two together and you realize that in 2005, China is poised to flood the U.S. market with cheap clothing and textiles. The belief is that American companies, as well as firms in smaller, less competitive countries who also make textiles and apparel, will suffer when the quotas end. 50 countries, including the U.S., have appealed to the WTO to extend the quotas past the end of this month. The WTO has not responded to that request, so some U.S. manufacturers have petitioned a consortium of U.S. government agencies, including the Commerce Department, and asked them to institute what are being called China safeguards. That, in turn, has made many retailers angry. They filed a lawsuit in U.S. court, the U.S. Court of International Trade, asking that the quotas be allowed to expire as originally planned. Joining me to sort out all the issues in this drama are Leonida Inge, WUNC's Changing Economy reporter. Welcome, Leonida.
Thanks, Frank.
And Gary Jareffi is a professor in the Department of Sociology at Duke University and the director of the Center on Globalization. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Leonida, let me start with you. Tell us a little more about this lawsuit. Who are the players and what's the worry?
Well, the lawsuit was filed by the U.S. Association of Importers of Textiles and Apparel. Translation, Frank, those are retailers, big
people
retailers.
Who sell it, right.
Oh, yeah. And this group is made up of about 200 retailers. It's no small group. Right. And they're upset because they say that the U.S. government they're just upset that they're even considering special safeguards against China, which could slow down the amount of textiles and apparel flowing into the United States. But that's, of course, exactly what, you know, textile industry leaders want, to stop or slow down, or at least slow down the alleged flood of Chinese imports into the U.S. once the worldwide quota system expires.
All right. And just to make it clear, I'm going to hold you right there and I'm going to talk to Gary Jareffi for just a moment. Right now, there are quotas in place. There are protections in place. Right, Gary?
That's right. And those quotas have been in existence since the early 1970s. So they've been with us for about 30 years.
Okay. They're about to expire. The retailers say, great, prices go down. People buy more stuff. Let it happen. Manufacturers say, hang on, we're not ready for this.
No, they're not ready for that, mainly because I guess it's been easier during this global shift for retailers to change. But one example is even Pillowtex down in Kannapolis, North Carolina. You know, that business was a dinosaur. You know how hard it is to make a dinosaur turn around and sit up and change the way it's been doing, you know, its work for so long. So that's what's happening. And textile manufacturers, they've been asking for at least 3 more years of these quotas, I guess just to be able to stay in business.
And Gary Jareffi, that is neoliberal conservative argument that these dinosaurs, if they can't change fast enough, don't deserve to live.
Well, you know, I think that we have to realize, Frank, that this system of protectionism, one of the things that's happened is it's allowed 50 or 60 different countries to actually have a major stake in the U.S. market. Mm. And the retailers that Leonida was mentioning about have really used this system very effectively to craft what they call global sourcing strategies, which basically means they can be the importers of record and be bringing these products in from many different countries around the world. I think the big concern with the phase out of these multi-fiber agreement quotas is that the number of significant importers, exporters to the U.S. Are going to go from 50 or 60 countries down to 5 or 6. And I think that everybody is going to have to make adjustments here. But the battle between the retailers and the manufacturers is on really, on the retailer end, they want to go to the places that they can get products the cheapest and can deliver low prices. The manufacturers are really concerned about whether or not they can retain a significant piece of this production system.
And one thing I wanted to say, Frank, is just to let people know, we're talking about the meat and potato type of textiles and apparel. We're talking about literally the cotton shirt you have on, cotton trousers, you know, the pants, your underwear. We're talking about sheets, pillowcases, and that's why so much is at stake now. And also, I think even bras, and also some of the garment wear that you know, people wear in hospitals. So we're talking about for men's, women's, children's, cotton clothes, man-made fiber clothes, just about everything we both have on.
Well, the interesting thing to me, Gary, is that certainly we're talking about an industry that affects us all. It's, as Leonita says, it's everything we're wearing. It's everything that's on our beds and pillowcases at home. But the fact is, if the stuff stays at the same price and we get it from the same 50 or 60 exporters at the current price, American buyers, consumers, aren't going to go anywhere else. In other words, what advantage do the retailers have if the price for every one of them goes down at the same time? Aren't they still competing for the same consumer that they are at the somewhat higher prices now under protectionism?
They are competing for the same consumers. I think that the big difference is when Multifiber, right now the quota system has basically limited China's percent of the U.S. market to about 16% of total U.S. apparel imports. That's about $1 out of every six. After this quota system expires, the projections are that by 2008, China is going to have a 50% share of U.S. textile and apparel imports, and China is the lowest wage, lowest cost exporter in the world. So I think what retailers are seeing here is that if the quota system expires and you can shift more and more production to China and also to India, which is projected to get 15% of the U.S. market, that's going to bring prices down at the retail level even lower than they are now.
Right, but as I say, that would be great for consumers, you would think. But the retailers, if they don't come down, they're still competing at the same relative prices at a higher level with China at 16% of imports. In other words, why are the retailers the ones who are asking for these lower prices when they know they're all going to be competing with each other for the same markets and the same producers?
It's a very good question. I think the retailers are basically committed as much as possible to a kind of free trade system with regard to these other countries. And since retailers have become such significant importers, I think they don't want to feel locked into these earlier arrangements that in many ways are sort of economically less efficient because you're spreading purchases over so many different countries, many of whom are quite small and don't supply a very large share of the market. So I think it would just facilitate the sourcing, especially of the largest retailers. I think we'd have to keep in mind that it's the big companies like Walmart, Target, Kmart, JCPenney that are probably most vested in switching over to a new system because they're producing, they're importing at such a large scale.
And Leonita, this also raises another interesting question. We're talking about globalization and the United States importing, so we're thinking of about the United States as a monolithic entity. But really, this pits two American constituencies against each other, the consumers and textile manufacturers, in a sense.
Yes, excuse me. Yes, it does. And it almost reminds me, this time last year, I was doing stories on how retailers were fighting furniture manufacturers. Almost the same thing. It wasn't necessarily quotas in place, but they were fighting for safeguards because they felt China was dumping cheap imports into the country. So it's, you know, this fight, I'm sure, will continue. And it's been going on, really hopping from industry to industry.
Well, what about this whole business of competitive advantage, Gary? I mean, if this is inevitable, at some point, U.S. manufacturers are going to have to come to grips with cheaper foreign labor and cheaper foreign imports. Shouldn't we be assisting U.S. manufacturers out of industries where the U.S. seems less competitive and not protecting them?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if we look at the textile and apparel industry, this is an industry that's been losing jobs in the United States since the early 1990s. In North Carolina alone, we went from about 180,000 textile jobs in 1983 to about 85,000 now. Apparel even got harder hit, 90,000 jobs in 1993, 30,000 now. So in a sense, I think that the textile and apparel manufacturers really have to make an adjustment to the fact that in these relatively labor-intensive industries like textiles, apparel, toys, footwear, sporting goods, the U.S. really has to start to produce smarter not try to compete with countries on the basis of low-cost labor. And I think one of the things we're seeing in the textile industry, for example, is that some U.S. manufacturers are moving towards what they call smart textiles, textiles that use high technology, chemical and biotech manufacturing methods to produce fabrics that have particular kinds of performance requirements, especially for athletics and other areas. So I think that that really U.S. textile companies and U.S. manufacturers more generally really have to take advantage of our innovative edge in the global economy and try to produce new products and regain shares of the market that we've been losing.
Leonid, are you seeing that happening? Are they making provisions for what happens in a few years?
Well, they definitely seem to be moving that way. I recently visited the College of Textiles at NC State University, and you know, wow, you should see the things they have in there. I mean, they can sew sweaters without seams. I mean, they have machines that can do that. They have the big Homeland Security grant where they have Pyroman, a dummy that does nothing but test the best equipment that firefighters would wear. Then they have another dummy in another room that does nothing but, I guess, run in sweat to see, you know, what kind of clothes and fabrics, you know, would benefit, you know, us, you know, what we'd like to wear. And so all that kind of testing is going on. And also right down the street from there, there's a company, TC Squared, Textile Clothing Technology Corporation. And they're the company that developed this, I guess, this dressing room box that you can step into and all these lights come at you and they can give you your exact measurements.
Technology be the competitive advantage that the U.S. enjoys. Leonid Inge and Gary Jareffy, thanks very much. Leonid Inge is WUNC's economics reporter, and Gary Jareffy is a professor in the Department of Sociology at Duke University and the director of the Center on Globalization, Governance, and Competitiveness. Just ahead, celebrating the life of a storytelling legend. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The voice of one of the world's best storytellers went silent this week. Jackie Torrance died of a heart attack Tuesday at her home in Salisbury, North Carolina. She was 60. When I heard the news, I felt as though I'd lost a close friend, which is strange because we'd never met, although I'd interviewed her twice. Perhaps I felt so close because we last spoke on this program just a week ago today. We asked her to be part of our show the day after Thanksgiving to help us encourage listeners to call in with stories of their own, stories about the holidays and families. She was an obvious choice because of her status as one of the most highly respected and best-loved storytellers in the business. She'd done 9 recordings, 3 award-winning TV specials, appeared on countless TV and radio programs, and won many honors, including the prestigious Annie Glenn Award and the World Storytelling Award. Besides, I knew she was a delight because I'd spoken with her 6 years ago on another program. During that interview, she told me how she developed an interest in telling tales.
My grandmother was always saying when he'd start up on a scary story, "You all excuse me. Lightning's going to strike this room, and I'm not going to be here to let it hit me. But me, I'd stay there right beside my granddaddy because I wanted to see who it was going to hit."
Maybe that's it. Maybe the reason I felt Jackie Torrance was a close friend was that a good storyteller is like lightning. Her stories knock you down and shake you up, and in a moment that lasts forever, become a part of you. Stories are powerful. Joseph Campbell says it's because they have mysterious qualities. He says unexpected developments in a story let us know that our experience is not orderly. Through the story, he says, we're propelled past our expectations into something larger. Maybe that's why, as I've come to learn, most good storytellers are at first reluctant to assume that title. A natural-born storyteller knows she'll be doing more than telling tales to amuse an audience. She'll be tossing lightning bolts that will propel us past our expectations. Jackie Torrance told me that as much as she loved to listen to stories, she never thought she'd be a storyteller. She said she had a speech impediment and knew she'd never be good enough. But then along came an unexpected development.
I was a reference librarian, and here it is on a January morning, and it's snowing. And it's not a lot of snow now. You must understand that we are a southern city, and that we just didn't get a lot of snow at that time. Mm-hmm. But still, even with a little bit of snow, there's some people who can't drive in snow. And the ladies of the children's department couldn't. So there was nobody at work. But that didn't stop the children. they were coming in on foot. Uh-huh. And my boss said, we're being overtaken by a gang of loud, wild kids. And there's nobody there. He said, we need somebody up there to manage them because, you know, we have a low staff this morning. Yeah. And I moved away thinking, well, he'll never ask me. But I think when I made that movement, he saw me and he said, yeah, you've got a little girl. You would know exactly what to do with them. Go upstairs and read him a story. And I decided to tell Little Red Riding Hood. Well, of course, the first thing out, we don't want to hear that. I said, oh, come on, you like this. No. Well, I thought about stories that were told to me in elementary school by a woman named Corrine Thomas, who was our librarian. I told one of her stories called Sody Saleratus, and the kids loved it. It was about a bear that ate up an old man, an old woman, a little girl, and a little boy, and a little pet squirrel with a great big bushy tail. And the kids kept saying, oh boy, make it eat up somebody else. And I thought, this is nice. I enjoyed them and they enjoyed me. From the very first time, I knew I liked that.
That was the beginning of a career that lasted more than 25 years. Along the way, she told her tales to thousands of children and adults all over the country. Now, you have to know that Jackie Torrance was a large woman who poured every ounce of herself into her stories. Yeah, she was big, but her expressions were bigger, and the characters she could create with her remarkable voice were gigantic. Dionne Bird lives in Salisbury, not far from Jackie's home. She remembers the first time she heard Jackie tell a story.
She came to my elementary school when I was in the fifth grade, and she came and told stories to our class.
Had you ever seen her before?
No.
Yeah, what was that like? What story did she tell?
She told Old Burr Possum and Old Burr Rabbit. I just remember that as soon as I heard that she had passed like that, it just came to my head.
How did the story affect you?
It just made me feel like I was there. She made it seem so real. It was just different the way she told it because she would, the voices, she would change her voice and make her voice sound different.
Have you seen her since?
No, I had not.
When you were told that a storyteller was coming to school, had there been other storytellers before?
Yes, it had.
How does she compare?
She was great.
And I wonder, by fifth grade, I guess you can start getting a little bit cynical. It's like, oh, no, we're too old. Is that how you felt going
in?
Yeah,
that's how we felt. Like, what is she going to be talking about? We're too old to be sitting on the floor, you know, listening to someone read us stories.
Mm-hmm.
But once she came, it was exciting. We were at a show.
How long did it take you to realize that this was going to be a different experience?
Just as soon as she started talking, she made it exciting from the beginning to the end. She had the audience. We were much involved. It was just so exciting because she just did different verses, different parts. And
she has wonderful facial expressions, too,
doesn't she? Oh, yeah. And her hands. She used her hands, and it was just real.
Well, Dionne, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You know, little kids, if you don't tell them anything to fear, they'll go to bed and find something to fear. Mama, it's a giant rolling around under my bed. Oh, no, darling, there's nothing under there. How do you know? I saw its hairy fingernails. You see, you tell them things like that to show them that, yes, you can be just as afraid as you like, but don't worry, Mama's here for you.
Storyteller Jackie Torrance, who passed away Tuesday at her home in Salisbury. Jackie had been seriously ill and confined to a wheelchair for the past several years. We're remembering her today on The State of Things with the help of some of her friends and colleagues, among them Donald Davis, a storyteller from Ocracoke. He's been at many festivals and events with Jackie and was on this program with her last Friday as we invited listeners to tell holiday stories Donald, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
What did you think when you heard the news?
It was almost unbelievable, and I was filled with such a sense of gratitude that we had been together on that interview just a few days before that.
And you were with her at her last public appearance. Was that
I was with her up in Jonesboro at the National Festival, which was her last appearance, at least at that event.
Mm-hmm. What was that? How was she then, and what was that like?
Well, Jackie had been struggling for years now, and getting around was very difficult for her. She was filled with a mixture of exhaustion and an exhilarated excitement at being once again in the middle of the people whom she loved and who loved her.
Because before that event, if I'm not mistaken, it had been quite a while.
It had been several years since she had been there. I can't remember exactly how many, but it had been multiple years. In leaving, she said, this will be my last time to be here.
Wow. What made her such a great storyteller?
Jackie was telling stories whether she was on stage or off, whether she was performing or simply in conversation at the dinner table. The stories simply flowed out of her, and they flowed out not just with words. They flowed out of her whole face and hands and body. They flowed out like pictures. You simply watched the stories while Jackie told them.
You know, she told us, and I think she's told other interviewers as well, that she was very reluctant. I mean, she listened to stories and loved them, but never imagined that she could be a storyteller and used to sort of hide and was shy about telling stories.
Well, I think that's true about many people who are the finest tellers, that you're pulled into it. It really is like a vocation, a sense of calling, that this is something you must do that you didn't mean to. And I think Jackie always had that sense. Jackie never came on saying, I want to tell you this. Oh, I'm so good. No, you pulled a little bit, and then the story came creeping out like a gift.
Do you think you were influenced by her? How have other storytellers been influenced?
Well, everybody was influenced by Jackie, if not directly, indirectly, because she blazed so many trails and opened so many doors for performing storytelling. Jackie took stories to places other storytellers had never ever been, and even tellers who never met her benefited from her life and her work.
How are we going to fill the void?
Well, tell more stories. Tell more stories. Jackie loved stories. She was an exquisite listener, which is half of the package. And to think about Jackie while we're telling, perhaps, is a thing to do.
Is that something that happens? Do storytellers in some ways memorialize other storytellers? I suppose you do from your influences. You're telling stories about grandparents and the people who told you the story. Other professionals as well, and sort of internalize their style or at least parts of it?
Oh, I'm sure of that, because it's an absorbed thing. As opposed to a purely studied thing, it rubs off like a person's first accented language, and so you know Jackie is part of us. That's part of why it hurts that she's gone, because it's tearing at a piece of each of us that we never got to adequately appreciate.
Donald, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, the first time you tell a story, you see that you like it. And I always say, don't ever tell a story you don't like, because you've wasted your time and the time of your listener. Then the second time you read it for the pictures. Read it for the pictures that you're going to create. As you read about the character, you read a personality into those characters. You give those characters a look. You see them as familiar individuals. They may look like your husband, your wife, your daughter, your son. The third time you read it for the words. Now, this is a very important part of the story, because words make that story. You can make it or break it by saying the right or wrong words. Sometimes when words are too abstract, children can't understand them. Mm-hmm. For instance, the king was so wicked. Well, what does that mean to a child of 3 or 4 years old who may not understand a king being wicked? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. Well, the king was wicked. He yelled at his wife. He stepped on his dog's tail. He kicked his cat and he pinched his mama. He was wicked.
We're celebrating the life of Jackie Torrance today on The State of Things. Among the many people Jackie influenced is Donna Washington. She's a professional storyteller, actress, and author in Durham, and she tours national festivals and schools year-round. Donna joins us on the phone from her home in Durham to talk about Jackie Torrance's impact on her life and career. Donna, welcome.
Thank you.
You knew Jackie. How did you meet?
I met Jackie back in 1990. I was at the Illinois Storytelling Festival. I was a native of the Illinois area at that point. I was living there. And she was featured at the Illinois Storytelling Festival. And I had been hearing about her since my days at Northwestern when I was studying storytelling in children's theater. So it was this overwhelming thing to actually meet her and then to get to see her perform. So I you know, after the 2 days of the festival, there was a sort of like a dinner over at Jim May's house, and I sat next to her.
Wow.
And spent the whole afternoon kind of staring at her in awe.
Well, what was it like?
Well, she was, you know, you expect someone who has actually got that much history. I mean, she, by that point, even then, she was a legend in the storytelling world, and especially to a young storyteller who had just really started. And she was so real. She was very personable. She was a lot of fun. And she was so easy to talk to, and you could ask her anything, and she would talk to you for 30 minutes about it.
Probably had a story or two to tell along the way.
She was the essence of storytelling. You couldn't ask her about something without getting a story or talk about something. She was storytelling.
Did she influence your style, the way you tell stories?
Very much. Very much so. I think that from the... I had been watching... I'd seen tapes of her when I was in school. But when I finally got a chance to watch her perform and to see how fluid her face was and how amazingly diverse her vocal patterns were. She could just be anything. And listening to all the sounds that would come out of her, I was amazed by how versatile, what such a versatile performer that she was, to the point of where the storyteller, I mean, a good storyteller disappears during the course of a story. And you're just kind of sitting in the story. You can see all the characters. You are where the storyteller has taken you. But by the same point, you're still aware of the fact that you're in the hands of a master storyteller. And she could do that better than anybody.
As you say that, that's an incredible statement about Jackie Torrance. She was a large woman.
Oh, yeah.
She had a presence in a room. And as you say, facial expressions were, you know, sort of had you wrapped. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're right. She disappeared.
Oh, yeah. That, like I said, that is the mark. When you can sit there and watch something so spellbinding that you are spellbound, that you're actually transported, you are gone, and you're wherever she took you, and you can, you're aware of the fact that, like I said, you're seeing all these facial expressions and all these voices, but you can also see all the characters. You're
right
there with Br'er Rabbit. She is Br'er Rabbit. I mean, it was, watching her perform has always been one of the most amazing things that I have had the privilege of doing.
We can talk about this, and it is all of what you say is quite striking, but now I'm asking you, can you learn this craft from someone else, or is it something that you're just born with?
Well, I think that anybody can learn how to do this. If you can learn how to stand in front of a group of people and present something, yes, you can learn how to do this. But the great ones, the masters like Jackie, there is some part of them that is really linked into story. I mean, she channeled the stories. I mean, it wasn't so much that she was just up there telling a story. So, yes, anybody can be trained to do it, but there comes a point where you diverge from the people who are competently trained to do it or who have some talent at it and the people who have mastered it. And Jackie kind of wrote the book, so to speak, on what it was to have mastered the art of doing this.
So what does her loss mean to the storytelling community and to the rest of us?
Well, there isn't anybody that I know of, that I've ever seen, that can approach what she does. I mean, we have lost one of the most unique voices that storytelling has. We have lost a powerhouse and an advocate. And, you know, she was a storytelling household name. I mean, most people don't even know what storytelling is, might know who Jackie Torrance is. So we have lost a kind of beacon of light for what storytelling can be, for its power. And also, we have lost a majestic person, but we've also lost just the personality, that the magic that she can bring that nobody else has.
Well, it sounds like we've lost Jackie, but on the other hand, there's a part of her that we'll have forever.
Yes. She, like I said, I know she very much has influenced how I perform, and I know that she has had an amazing amount of influence on so many other young performers coming up. And she has her own folklore. There are stories people tell about Jackie Torrance.
Ooh, what's your story?
Well, the first story I ever heard about Jackie Torrance was from a person who was one of my mentors when I was in university, and we were sitting around talking, and she asked me, "Have you ever seen Jackie tell?" And that was the first time I'd heard of Jackie Torrance. I said, "No, what are you talking about?" And so she tried to describe her. She said, "She's a large woman, and she wears these gorgeous dresses, and she has all these big jewelry, and I was out in New Jersey, and I saw her performing, and there's this kid sitting in the front row, can't sit on his hands. He's jumping up and down. Finally, Jackie stops the story. She says, "What is wrong?" And the kid says, "Are all those sounds you're making coming out of your brooch?" Because he couldn't imagine that she would be able to make that kind of noise with her voice. So there must be some mechanical thing going on. So, yeah, so that was the first story I heard of Jackie Torrance. I've heard stories about how she put the IRS in their place and all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of stories about Jackie.
Jackie in the IRS office.
Yes.
That's the story I want to hear. But I guess that's for another time.
Yes.
Donna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Once there lived a little girl named Marie and a little boy named Michael.
Jackie Torrance leaves us with a story when the state of things continues. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're remembering the life of Jackie Torrance, the North Carolina storyteller with a worldwide reputation. She died Tuesday of a heart attack at her home in Salisbury. Many of her stories are collected on the 9 recordings she made. Here's one called The Yellow Ribbon.
Once there lived a little girl named Marie and a little boy named Michael. They were both the same age. And one day, when they were 6 years old, they played on the playground. Marie was in her swing when Michael walked over and said, "Marie, that's a pretty red dress you have on." And Marie said, "Thank you." And then Michael said, "But why do you have that yellow ribbon around your neck?" And Marie said, "I can't tell you." When they were both 12 years old, they were sitting in the library at school. Marie was reading a magazine, and Michael walked over and said to her, "I like that pretty green dress." And Marie said, "Thank you." Michael said, "But Marie, why do you have a yellow ribbon around your neck?" And Marie said, "I can't tell you." They both went to high school. They must have been at least 16 or 17 years old. And this was the night of the junior prom. Marie was all dressed up in a beautiful blue gown. Michael walked over to Marie, handed her a flower, and said, "This is for you." And Marie said, "Oh, Michael, this is beautiful." And he said, "That's a beautiful blue dress." And Marie said, "Thank you. You're quite handsome yourself." Michael said, Marie, could I just ask you something?" And Marie said, "Of course. What is it?" "Why do you have that yellow ribbon around your neck?" And Marie said, "I can't tell you."
all the way through college, they were good, good friends. Just before they left college, Michael said to Marie, "Marie, I'll probably never see you again. Why, you'll go off somewhere in the world, and I'll go off somewhere in the world, and we'll never see one another again. And I don't want that to happen. Would you marry me?" And Marie said, "Yes." But Michael said, "Would you please tell me, before we get married, why do you wear that yellow ribbon around your neck?" And Marie said, "I'll tell you after we get married." It was their wedding day. And Michael was very handsome, and Marie was beautiful. As she stood with Michael in her wedding gown, he said to her, "I have never seen such a beautiful bride as you." And Marie smiled and said, "Thank you, Michael." He said, "Now tell me one thing. Why do you have that yellow ribbon around your neck?" And she said, "I'll tell you later." Well, they were married for at least 40 years. And they had children, and their children had children. And one day, when they were very, very old, Michael and Marie were sitting on the front porch of their home. And they were rocking back and forth in their rocking chairs. And Michael said to Marie, "We've lived a long time, my dear. We've had a good life. We're old now. I just want to ask you a question before we pass on. Would you please tell me why you wear that yellow ribbon around your neck?" And Marie said, "We did have a good life, didn't we, Michael? And we are indeed old folk now, aren't we? And I know we won't live much longer. So I guess I can tell you why I wear this yellow ribbon around my neck. But Michael, I'd rather show you why I wear this yellow ribbon around my neck." With shaking hands, Marie slowly took one hand and then the other. And slowly she pulled the ends of the yellow ribbon. And as she pulled the ends of the yellow ribbon, her head fell off. And that's the end of that.
Jackie Torrance. She left us November 30th, 2004, to join the immortals who live once upon a time. Funeral services will be held next Tuesday, December 7th at 2 p.m. at Livingstone College's Varick Auditorium. The members of the Durham-based reggae band Dub-A-Dis hail from all over the globe. Their sound, as varied as their nationalities, ranges from traditional Ethiopian rhythms to roots reggae. Dub-A-Dis will be playing Friday at Temple Ball in Carrboro. Today we welcome the band's two founders, Dereje Tesfe and Freso Taye, to the program. Both originally hail from Ethiopia. Welcome.
Hello, Frank.
What kind of music did you grow up listening to in Ethiopia?
Traditional Ethiopian music, as well as reggae and a little bit of jazz and pop and blues.
Did you start out? Were you musicians there? How long were you there? And did you think you were going to be a musician?
Well, I didn't play music while I was there. I was 16 when I came. I started playing after I got here.
Same thing for me, too. We haven't played music back home, but we came here and we've met, and he taught me how to play keyboard.
Wow. When did you get interested in music? Was it here?
In 92, yeah. I had friends there from a different section of the islands, and they were musicians, so I got to hang out with them and learn different instruments, and that's where it began for me.
So who are your reggae heroes?
Bob Marley, Stu Pauls, Bernie Spear.
Culture.
Yes.
What do you think is the appeal of reggae? It has really been powerful and appealing music certainly in the United States and around the world for decades now. Why so?
I guess the way it tells a story, reggae is the music of the people, and a lot of people can relate to it, whatever your nationality and your race is. So I think that's the main thing. It attracts people.
Yeah, sometimes now it's overtly political, so certainly you can identify with what's going on. Although sometimes narrowly political, it's so narrowly that you wonder how you can identify. Is there something else maybe at the spiritual level that's going on at the same time?
I say probably the rhythm is a very happy rhythm, and politically, it's like I said, it's people of the voice of the people.
Well, let's listen to one of your tracks. We'll get a feel for it and find out how much of reggae is in there and what other influences you bring. This one is called Dar Escadar. Dar Escadar, tell us, what does that mean?
It means border to border. This was a song that was written for King Tedros during the time when there was war with British back then in Ethiopia. And we have changed it into English first. And put it into a reggae rhythm.
So this would have been a well-known song in Ethiopia. About when? When was this?
I would not say it would be well-known. It was sang by Ethiopian troubadours, so it wasn't any recorded.
How old is the original song then? How far back does this go?
That's 1889? Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a song. It was just like a poem.
A poem.
Wrote for the king.
And they also have an instrument. It's called masinko. It's made out of a horse tail. It's a like a violin kind of thing. Yeah. So they would play that. And
one or two strings, maybe?
Just one string. Yes.
How did you find out about the poem? How did you discover it?
Books back home. When I was in elementary school, they would teach us about different kings in Ethiopia and what's been said about them, what's been sang about them. So I've read it back then and just happened to be in my memory for a long time. So I wrote it down.
Tell me a little about the troubadour tradition in Ethiopia. How far back does that go?
It goes very, very, very far. It's a really common thing to do. You see musicians expressing, pretty much they were the news tellers.
Yes.
For the people.
Basically, it's a noose.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the origins of our profession here. We couldn't just sit in one place and get lazy, tell the whole country the same thing all at once. But you get to change the story from place to place, which is another, which is the good news, I guess. You don't have to be accountable for what you said in the last town. So how much of that tradition, the poetry, makes its way into what we would consider Ethiopian pop music today?
Not a lot, because during Mengistu's time, which was the communist government, which did not allow people to express themselves, so most of them was being oppressed and not being said. So not a lot of them has been told.
So we lost our connection with that during the 17 years of communist regime in Ethiopia. So not a lot. It's completely different now.
Do you feel that that's an important part of your music or an important part of your message, in a sense, to rediscover some of that and reincorporate it into your music?
Totally.
Yeah.
And then it comes through and it's a different voice. How much do you suppose the influence of being a repressed voice plays in expression? We see this over and over again in especially popular culture, that the most popular forms come from the voice of the people who seem most oppressed.
Go ahead.
You think it's accurate? Is it an accurate assessment?
I believe so, yes. Well, if we are talking about reggae music, this originated in Jamaica, of course.
Right.
And as we all know, Jamaica is a very poor country. And yes.
We also talked a little bit about pop music, and only our own Keith Weston could have an entire hard drive full of, get this, 60s Ethiopian pop.
Pop music, yeah.
You don't have a hard drive full of, do you?
No, I don't.
No,
Keith does. And so I'd like to hear some of that and get your response to it.
Yeshibeti, many home knatu, many home knatu. I know Chitrabu, the rest is out. Yezeke, yeshibeti, mendina home knatu, many home knatu. I know Chitrabu, the rest is
out. And I think that's Mahmoud Ahmed.
Mahmoud Ahmed, yes.
Yeah, and are you familiar with his music?
Yes.
How long a reign did Mahmoud? Because this stuff sounds very current in some ways. Any of this kind of music influence the stuff you do?
Yes. To our time, to our music, yes. This is the type of music we are more influenced to than the older 60 pop. This is most recent. Yes, we are.
To what extent do you think you were influenced? Your current style is influenced by that growing up.
Not a lot, because we've been through different places and we've played with a lot of musicians from around the world. So I can't say that's played a major role in our music, but as part of
it's got part of it, yeah.
What's happening, do you think, to music in general now that with the world music revolution, I suppose you could call it, a lot of the regional stuff, is it dying out and becoming homogenized, or is it becoming more interesting because we're all getting together?
When it comes to reggae music, I believe roots reggae music, you know, they say it's dying out and there's new reggae. But to me, reggae music, roots reggae is completely a different type of music than the new reggae. Mm. So, no, it's not dying out, no.
Well, Freso Taye, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dereje Tesfaye, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to two members of Dubadis. The band performs around the Triangle area. They'll be playing at Temple Ball in Carrboro on Friday night, December 3rd. That's the State of Things for today. Program directed by Keith Weston, edited by Dave DeWitt, produced by Stephanie Hirsch, Corey Princell, our technical director, Robin Copley, senior producer, Susan Davis, executive producer of the State of Things is Fred Wasser. Thanks for listening. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.